Okay, so let's get started. So, if we could start by you just introducing yourself and explaining a little bit to people about how you decided to go into science as a career.
Yes. So my name's Yael Courtney. I recently got my PhD in neuroscience, where I study the brain, but now I'm working as a postdoc, which is like a next step of scientist, where I still work under a boss who's a principal investigator of a research lab, but I have more freedom to pursue my own questions in the lab. So that's what I'm doing now. I'm working as a scientist at Stanford University and the Veterans Administration Hospital healthcare system there. But how I got into science was many years ago, of course. I was in high school and trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life, like I think a lot of people do in high school. And, I was thinking about the things I was good at and that I liked, which was, it felt like a lot of things. It could be whatever. But then I also had to do something as a job. But at the same time, I was experiencing a lot of like unsettling, like personal life experiences where I ended up leaving home at 15. And I was briefly in like the court and the child protective services system. And what this meant was that I met a lot of foster kids and people with like all kinds of really challenging mental health situations. And I didn't know almost anything about this at the time, but I met people with all these different mental health conditions. And they would tell me stories about going to therapists and psychiatrists and being told that there wasn't any cure for what they had and that we didn't understand mental health conditions. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, we don't have a cure or a treatment and we don't understand what's going on. And so I got fascinated with the brain and mental health conditions. And I learned that, it wasn't that these therapists were like inept or bad, which is what my initial thought had been. It was that, oh, like as humanity, we just don't understand what's going on in the brain a lot of times. And so I became interested in how the brain works and what's going wrong. And maybe if we understood better what was going wrong, we could help people with various brain problems kind of across the spectrum of mental health and psychiatry was what I was really interested in then. And so I didn't actually end up graduating from high school. I got my GED and I worked at a Wendy's and I read a bunch of books and I was just thinking about life. And I read a lot of books about the brain and about abnormal psychology and about mental health. And I was like, well, who gets to work on this stuff? Who are the people who would be finding anything that could help? And that's where I kind of learned that, neuroscience is a field and there's people who just study the brain and how it works. And a lot of them are studying it so that we hopefully can come up with better treatments for people. And so that convinced me that I needed to go to college because I learned that, basically the path to get into doing your own science and in a way that's recognized broadly is to go to college, get your degree, and work as a scientist and work in research. So I said I was going to do that. And then along that path, I realized I should go to grad school too, because the PhD is kind of what equips you to be the most independent scientist and able to work in a lot of different kinds of spaces. And so I got my PhD in brain science. And now I continue to ask questions about the brain, though my interests kind of shift and change depending on the time.
So tell me a little bit about your PhD research.
Yes. Oh, it's so cool. So I started my PhD thinking I want to study neuroplasticity, which is this idea that the brain is plastic, which means that it can change over time. And it can change as you learn. It can change in healing ways where the brain becomes like stronger after bad things happen. And I wanted to study this, but I also wanted a good mentor who was going to teach me how to do great science. And in most PhD programs, you can pick who you work with. And so I found this mentor named Dr. Maria Lettinen at Boston Children's Hospital, who I just loved the way she thought about science and approached science. And what her lab studies was before babies are born, how their brains form. And a little bit less about plasticity, a little bit more about how the brain is built in the first place and what can go wrong. So what I ended up studying for about 5 years was if a mother takes different kinds of medications during pregnancy, which ones might get to the developing embryo and which ones might have an effect on that developing brain in ways that might cause a baby to not have their brain built right in ways that might manifest as a neurological disorder, as a developmental disorder, or other things like that. So more specifically, I looked at the serotonin system and how different medications, like some prescribed for epilepsy or schizophrenia, that activate some subsets of receptors, they go right through the placenta, they do get to the embryo, and they activate receptors in this embryo's brain, and their neurons don't form right. And so a lot of what I did was that in my PhD, which not only applies to prescription medications in those cases, but also applies to recreational drugs like psychedelics, which activate serotonin systems a lot. So when I tell people just kind of for a laugh, in one sentence, what I did for my PhD, I say, don't take acid if you're pregnant. Like, that's really the takeaway. And it's hasn't been clearly shown before. And a lot of my work just said, you know, drugs that activate these specific serotonin receptors are bad during pregnancy because they change the way an embryo's brain forms.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So what kind of models were you using to look at that?
So you cannot do these studies in humans. It's super unethical. And of course, there are humans who took acid when they were pregnant. However, retrospective studies, which means studies that look back on what happens in these situations, aren't very helpful for this because it is the case that most people, if they took acid when they were pregnant, were also taking other substances or had kind of other behaviors that we know are definitely bad for babies. And so if someone was drinking alcohol and then took acid one time, it's just really hard to say. So we studied mice, which is tremendously sad in some ways, but also you do have to study an animal system if you're going to study pregnancy and what medication might go through a pregnant organism to the embryo and affect its brain. So I studied mice and I would experiment with giving pregnant mice different medications and in the most humane way possible, look at the embryo either right before birth, like very quickly after. I could say, did the medication get to the embryo? And just do chemistry experiments to see if it got there. Or I would let the embryo be born and then look at the baby mouse's brain and say, did this form the way that a normal mouse brain would have formed? Because we know that a lot of things about how medications and other stuff can impact brain development, if it's bad for a mouse, it's probably bad for a person, right? Human brain development is even more sensitive than a lot of other mammalian brain development. So if something's bad enough that it's messing up a mouse when it's born, humans definitely shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, I want to make a really, what I think is an important point about this because, you know, the current administration has set this goal to look at chronic diseases, and they're particularly interested in the increase in neurodevelopmental disorders and the effects of environmental factors that might play
super important.
And so, yeah, I think it's just important for people to realize that these are exactly the kinds of studies that are necessary if we want to understand, you know, what environmental changes might be impacting developing children. These are exactly the types of paradigms and experiments that we need to keep doing to find the answers to those questions. Okay, so then tell me a little bit about, you know, how you decided on your postdoc topic, and it sounds like you switched fields a little, so what motivated that?
Yeah, so I did switch fields, and it's something that I switched to something that's been an interesting question to me for a long time, but recently became interesting to a lot more people. And the big question is, why do some people not get better after a virus? And specifically, why do some people have problems in their brains after viruses for a long time? And this is not a new question. There's many viruses over the years, including influenza, including Epstein-Barr virus, which most people just call mono or infectious mononucleosis. And it's been the case for years that, you know, most people, you get sick with something, you go to the doctor, they give you a flu test. Oh, it's the flu. They give you medicine, you get better. But for every virus, there's actually always been a small percent of people who don't recover and who have long whatever it is, right? People now are familiar with this term long COVID, but it's not really new. There's always been a small group of people who don't recover after viral infection, some of whom have brain problems, whether that's brain fog, so like lower cognitive ability, like your memory shot, you just can't do stuff as complicated as you used to be able to do, or kind of more neurological and autonomic nervous system issues, like your heart rate isn't the same as it was anymore. You're just incredibly fatigued all the time. Your circadian rhythm, your sleep cycle might be messed up. These aren't really new issues, but because when SARS-CoV-2 kind of came as a pandemic, so many people got it at the same time. We were kind of able to see that even a small percent of people whose symptoms didn't go away represented millions of people because like almost everyone in the world got COVID.
From a scientific perspective, how do, you know, because these are correlations, right? You have a virus and then you just don't feel well afterwards. So what are the methods that scientists have used to actually determine that these are real phenomenon and not some sort of psychosomatic?
That's one of the things that's actually made this so hard to study in the past. Because if, you know, it's pretty rare that like one virus sweeps the world at one time. Like the flu is just, you know, here and there every year, it rises, it falls. with COVID, we had an interesting situation where even with COVID, it was a little bit hard, but you could see that someone was fine, like perfect health, like especially like good examples here are like young, healthy athletes, say, like not a problem in the world. They get sick and then they get COVID. They get a diagnosis and a test, a PCR test that said they definitely had COVID. And then they can get another PCR test that says, oh, they do not have coronavirus in them anymore. But they go to their doctor and they say, hey, I'm not better. Like I have all these problems. And then how do you know it's not psychosomatic? Well, at first, people would say that. They'd say, you know, you need to maybe get back in your exercise routine. You need to, like, I don't know, make sure you're getting sleep at night. But now scientists have had various biomarkers that there's not a perfect one yet, but they can check the blood of people who are saying these things. And they can say, oh, man, like, you actually have a lot of inflammatory markers that are really high that we wouldn't expect to see in a healthy person at all. So even though we think that coronavirus is gone, it's not showing up on these tests anymore. Yeah, something's wrong in your body. Your inflammatory levels are super high. And that's one example. For some people, it is these markers of inflammation that are really the warning sign in the blood that something in the body hasn't gone back to normal. There's a few other realms of measurable tests that you can give someone to say, well, something hasn't gone back to normal in your body.
Cool. Okay, so yeah, keep going.
So they're called chronic post-acute infectious syndrome. So acute is when, you know, you're super sick with something, but then you don't get better. So it's a post-acute infectious syndrome. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, this becomes chronic disease. And so I really actually love the phrase, make America healthy again. I think it's an awesome goal. And I think that addressing chronic illness is a very, very important thing. And I think one area of chronic illness is when people don't get better from sicknesses. And prior to COVID, there wasn't really that much research funding or interest. And so a lot of patients who, not COVID, before COVID, had a virus, didn't get better, have felt really abandoned by the medical and the research fields because there wasn't really grants for them. And a lot of people have this diagnosis of myalgic encephalomyelitis or chronic fatigue syndrome, which is often abbreviated MECFS. And this patient population has felt extremely abandoned over the years and like no one's researching what happened to them. And a lot of times this is because it's hard to prove what infection might have caused it. So a lot of these cases, there's evidence that people felt normal, got sick with something, got better from something, and then weren't okay. But just having a unified group of people that we definitely know the cause and we definitely know they didn't get better was missing. And so during COVID, that chance kind of came to study not only people with long COVID, but also people who might have these long-term illnesses triggered by something else. And so, you know, as I was wrapping up my PhD, I said, now might be the time where I can study this question. That's really important to me. And indeed, there were grants that were given now to help not only people with long COVID, but to investigate more broadly why do some people get sick with these kind of things, others don't? What's causing it? And if you can find the cause, can we develop a therapeutic for it?
Very cool. So what are the particular experiments or, you know, projects that you're working on related to
that? Yeah. So I joined a lab run by a man named Bill Robinson at Stanford. And his lab studies autoimmune diseases. And we think that at least for some people, these long-term conditions might be autoimmune, which means that your immune system is attacking your own body or, in what I want to study, your own brain. And so we think that what happens is that when you're sick with COVID, for this example, but it could be a different virus, something gets rewired and rewired incorrectly in your immune system. So your immune system has a lot of different kinds of cells, but one kind of cell is called a B cell. And the B cell helps to recognize enemies in your body. And it's like, oh, that's the bad guy. Like, I'm going to help your body get rid of this by like recruiting T cells to attack it. And in autoimmune disorders, B cells can get confused and they can say, this is the enemy, but it's actually your own cell that's like perfectly healthy. And so a good example is multiple sclerosis, where we know that B cells attack myelin, which is this thing that covers your neurons and helps them work. But B cells accidentally think that's bad. And they make your body kill it. And so we think that in some of these long-term conditions, the initial virus infection is messing with B cells forever. And it's making them recognize the wrong enemies, especially ones in your brain. So you just kind of constantly have this inflammation, this attacking going on because your B cells have gotten confused. And so we study these long-term conditions in the context of autoimmunity, specifically as it applies to B cells having the wrong enemies now. And so I study a lot like what's going wrong initially with those B cells, But a lot of what I do is I take blood from people with long COVID or not, people who got COVID and recovered. And I can take out their B cells and I can look at who they're trained to attack. We have these types of experiments. We can do sequencing or we see what receptors these B cells express. And the receptors tell you who they're finding and who they are identifying as the bad guys. And so then I can say, okay, it's saying this is a bad guy in a long COVID patient. And that actually is part of the brain. Oh, so this means the long COVID B cells. And I haven't shown that yet, but that's what I'm looking at. That's when I have blood from people who recovered and didn't recover. I'm looking at whether their B cells are different and whether this might be an autoimmune condition.
It's very interesting, I have to say, on a personal level, because 2 years ago, my mom, she got Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Wow.
Which is also an autoimmune disorder that affects the nerves. And she was paralyzed from the neck for a good, well, it took her like a year to be able to walk again, but she was completely paralyzed for months.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
But it's, you know, when I started, I actually like, it was embarrassing because I'm a neuroscientist and I had no idea that this disease existed once she got it. Because I'm focused on mental health disorders and, you know, very far removed from that world. And then when I started looking into research, I realized there's really not that much. And, you know, it's probably because it's very rare, very hard to recruit people to such studies. So it's interesting that, you know, COVID gives this opportunity to use this to study these kinds of questions that might be challenging otherwise.
I also want to say something else here, which there's another lab at Stanford, and Guillain-Barré syndrome actually can come after a vaccine, right? Yeah. And so a misconception I think a lot of people have is that scientists aren't studying vaccine injury and that we're not acknowledging that vaccines, including the COVID vaccine, can harm people. And I think that, you know, there's many reasons for that, but I kind of want to dispel that because there are people in the immunology department here with us at Stanford who are specifically studying vaccine injury, whether that's an allergic reaction or the development of Guillain-Barré syndrome, because we absolutely do not want that to happen. And we are really working to understand what is it about some people that makes them vulnerable to developing what is a very rare side effect. It's extremely rare after these vaccines, but it's bad. And we don't want that to happen to anyone. So there are incredible teams of researchers at the nation's kind of biggest institutions who are working hard to understand why these things happen in conjunction with, you know, my work, which is showing, you know, the way that these infections themselves are quite bad and the long-term damage they can cause. We are very avidly researching all of these paths.
It's a very challenging thing because, you know, in my mom's case, she did not get it. Everyone asked her that, like every nurse.
Yeah.
What did you get the COVID vaccine recently? And it wasn't. Yep. She just had a run-of-the-mill virus.
Like, yes. But that could also trigger it.
So, you know, there's nothing to say like which thing is going to cause it. But it's also, you know, I think interesting because, you know, doctors, I think they really do pay attention to their patients. And, you know, her recommendation now, which really upset her at first, was that she is not allowed to get any vaccines anymore. They just told her.
And like, that's probably correct.
It's not a good choice for her.
There are a subset of people who are incredibly like prone to reactions like this, and we should protect them. And but it just means we really need to understand who in a population is vulnerable to this. You know, everyone else, we need to understand who vaccines are safe for. And it's going to be most people. But we need to understand who that is. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm curious, you know, I think you told me that your project was originally slated for being cut, but then was reinstated. Yeah. So I was just curious if you could tell me a little bit about what happened there. And also,
absolutely,
you know, if it had been cut, how that would have impacted you.
I think a lot of patients with these types of diseases and scientists were really encouraged when, you know, from 2020 to 2022, the U.S. government, including the National Institutes of Health, recognized long COVID. And they recognized that there was a lot of people struggling with these disorders. And they set aside a good amount of funding that does come from taxpayer money. So, you know, after taxes are paid, Congress sets the budget. Every year, a certain amount of that budget goes to the National Institutes of Health. And these institutes have research priorities for funding, and they fund all kinds of disease research and basic science research on a host of things. And so after COVID hit and we realized that long COVID was a real problem, the NIH was able to say, we think this is quite important, and we think that we would like to set aside a chunk of money for researchers to study this. And so one of their initiatives that they made was called the RECOVER Initiative, which was about, you know, how do we make sure people are getting better from COVID? Why are some people not recovering? And we want to fund studies into both therapeutics for it and the pathobiology of it, which means how it starts biologically in the body. And so my lab had a grant under the Recover Pathobiology Way, which, you know, we think it's maybe this autoimmune thing. And so we're going to study the patient's B cells. And we got some hundreds of thousands of dollars to do this. And, you know, that can pay the salary of a postdoctoral researcher like me. And without money for a specific line of questioning in a lab, if that's not the lab's main focus, and my lab's main focus is not COVID, then it can be really hard to justify a project looking at something you don't have money for. So last week, there's been an incredible amount of restructuring going on in terms of scientific funding in the country, and an attempt to, you know, cut costs. And right now, the way that's being executed is sometimes just by wholesale cutting programs. And so last week, they did cut all Recover Pathobiology grants. They said, you know, we're not funding them anymore. In fact, starting, you know, with your next month's payment, you won't be getting them. These grants are done. We think they're not helping. And, you know, as far as we knew at that day, that was final because other programs had been cut and they had not come back. But I think due to a mix of incredible advocacy from patient groups and scientists, including some Congress people who were really allies in recognizing this is a problem that affects at least 16 million Americans, which is a huge number of people, with implications for many other Americans. And, you know, this administration's emphasis on chronic illness, some absolutely magical mixture of all of that advocacy and allies in Congress made it so that 2 days later, the Recover Pathobiology grants were actually reinstated. And that's a really rare case, and we are deeply thankful. But without that reinstatement, like for my personal project, I can't focus on COVID anymore. I can't be spending money on these rather expensive sequencing experiments if we don't have a grant to study COVID. I can still study B cells, and I can study, you know, how they react in autoimmunity, but I can only study conditions that we have money to study. And so I would have been heartbroken. And I already still am applying to many other types of foundations and organizations to get money so I can make sure I continue to do work that helps these patients. But without money for a project, I can't do the project. And so I would have had to stop for X number of months until I somehow found a different funding organization who cared about this.
I also want to ask, or I've been asking everyone also about indirects, because that's been another topic that I think a lot of people have no idea how indirects work. I mean, I don't
totally
even understood indirects until like late into my postdoc.
Yep.
But, you know, so the government has attempted and at least is proposing indirect cuts to 15%.
Right.
And I'm sure Stanford is higher than 15%.
Ours is 54% or 55%. Yeah.
Mine is much higher, actually.
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, I was surprised Stanford's was so low, actually, because I came from Boston Children's Hospital, where I think we're up at like 72% now. It's quite high.
Yeah. So I wanted to know if you know, you know, what types of things in your project that people might not realize that indirects cover, because I think a lot of people think that indirects is just things like electricity or, you know, janitorial staff.
Right.
In my case, for example, indirects cover like our animal care staff. They cover a lot of our microscopes. And so I like to know for the individual projects, what indirect support for your project doesn't directly come from your grant funding?
Yeah. So Stanford as an institution has a lot of incredible centralized research infrastructure. And what I mean by that is that not every lab group has to reinvent the wheel when it comes to scientific things that a lot of people use. And so I'll be more specific because I think that's a little vague right now. The type of research I do, looking at these B cells and who they might be attacking, I use a technique called sequencing, where we basically say, what is every piece of DNA in these cells? And the data sets you get when you do the sequencing are huge. They just take up an unbelievable amount of storage and memory. And to do any analysis on them, to kind of really figure out what they mean, takes a ton of computational power. So Stanford has these computational power like resources and cores, where you can use their supercomputers to make the analysis much more efficient and effective and actually possible at all. Like, I can't do this on my laptop. It doesn't work for that. And so one place indirect costs go is Stanford's computational support system for researchers. And without that, like, you can buy a desktop computer that's powerful enough to do this, but it's very expensive and it's not very efficient or effective at all. So Stanford maintaining these centralized resources like these supercomputers that allow researchers in biology labs to use computational power that's absolutely necessary to figure out what's going on with someone's immune cells. That's one example of something that is supported by indirect costs here. That's, I mean, we're going to have to figure out what to do.
I think more familiar with that because of AI and, you know, the for supercomputers to use generative AI. So I hope people, now can understand that concept, because definitely for me, that was very confusing. This idea that you need like centralized supercomputers that take a lot of money.
It's like, I totally agree with this administration's focus on efficiency, right? I think we should be keeping an eye out for areas in research where things can be more efficient and less wasteful. But I think indirect costs actually are often really good at that already because they help go to centralized strong infrastructure that supports all researchers at an institution with things like, and just one example, this computational power. That's actually quite an efficient way to strengthen institutions rather than giving individual labs lots of money to do things separately. It's better for indirects to go towards strengthening these centralized systems and make everyone's research better.
Right, exactly. Like I always think of the huge microscopes. Like we have these microscopes that are hundreds of thousands of dollars. And imagine if every lab needed to buy their own. It would be so wasteful.
So I think maybe just explaining like a core facility. So a core facility is kind of like what I just said with computing. But yeah, there are microscopes that are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, that also come with yearly maintenance contracts of like $50,000 because they're so specialized and the stuff they need to fix it and the knowledge someone needs. And, you know, even at these very rich institutions like Stanford or Harvard, where I did my PhD, they are very rich, yes, but it's not a good system for individual labs to be buying microscopes on this scale. It's best if the university has, you know, there's entire rooms and floors dedicated to maintaining these really nice microscopes that any researcher in the neuroscience department or in all of Harvard can come use if they need to image something at the absolute best resolution possible. And a lot of the maintenance for cores can come from indirects, right? That's how we make sure that everyone has access to this microscope and it stays working and it stays useful for everyone. So that's another example.
Yeah. And I think actually a lot of times in the direct grant mechanisms, they actually don't want you to apply for equipment that will be used for general purposes because the idea is, right, that they're funding this particular project and they don't want to fund your $100,000 microscope that you are going to use for 10 projects when they really just want to fund this one particular question. Right.
Which is totally fine. But you then also need mechanisms that allow this efficient sharing of powerful resources and infrastructure for each institution. Yeah.
So I think one of the last questions I have is actually I've been trying to ask everyone if they, maybe I should have prepped you in advance. But anyway. So if you have one in the spur of the moment, asking people if they have like a favorite story of a basic science research question that, you know, sort of was not immediately obvious how it would be helpful to humanity, but turned out to be very useful. Because I think that's another area that, you know, people don't quite understand. You often have certain Congress people who will pick research projects and be like, this is such a silly project. Why are American taxpayers funding it? But so many of them can turn out to become really important. So I just like to hear if people have one that they like to talk about.
So I have two. The first one I'll make very, very quick because it's just like one sentence to summarize, which is that Ozempic came from Gila monster spit. So, you know, if you say, well, why would we research lizard spit? That seems like a waste of $300,000. Sure, it might sound like that. But now, you know, many people are taking Ozempic. It's helping with this obesity crisis we have in America. And it's improving health outcomes across an almost unbelievable number of spheres for people. And that came from studying Gila monster spit and saliva. So I can imagine that that original grant, if you're a random congressperson, it might be hard to quickly understand what value that could have. But the second example I'll give is actually how insulin was made possible. So it used to be that if you had type 1 diabetes, it was effectively a death sentence and a quality of life sentence, right? You might live to your mid-20s, like maybe if you were super, super careful and modulated everything, but regardless, your life was going to be short. And nowadays, type 1 diabetes, yeah, it's like unfortunate. You have to get shots. You have to monitor your blood glucose, but it's fine because we have insulin and people can get insulin. But the reason that's possible is because some weird little niche biologists were interested in studying E. coli, this bacteria. And they were interested in how the genes of E. coli worked and how life in bacteria and life's genetic coding worked in this one teeny bacteria. So again, I can imagine if you're a congressperson reading a grant, you're like, why do people want to edit genes in bacteria? And so the original project that made insulin possible was looking at how you could put different genes into these E. coli bacteria and you could splice new DNA into them. And so it ended up making possible a technology called recombinant DNA. And we actually then learned how to put insulin genes into bacteria and have bacteria produce insulin for us. And then that ended up making synthetic insulin possible as well. And so the first research happened at a basic science level in labs funded by the NIH. And once they showed that the idea was possible, that's when pharmaceutical companies like Lilly came in and said, hey, we see a path here. We think we can make insulin available to people and we're going to make money. And they did. And now people can get insulin. This all happened because of a rather silly experiment about can we play with DNA in this one type of bacteria? And now people can get insulin and diabetes is not a death sentence. And I think, you know, between that and Ozempic, hopefully the example of how studies that might not sound all that compelling initially are super important for people's health in a way that we recognize every day now.
Ozempic is also my example. And it's also such a good, you know, for me, I think it's that part, but also the amount of studies that people did in rodents that showed the effects on intake. Before, you know, I always sort of make fun of, like, I have a lot of friends that are GIs and they're
totally
saying, and cardiologists, and they're always like, oh, you know, Ozempic was for diabetes and they just happened to find that it also affected weight loss. And I'm like,
yeah,
like we knew that for decades.
Yeah.
From animal research, you know, like there's like a clinical path to getting it approved and diabetes affects so many people that that's the most clear path for pharmaceuticals. But I don't think any scientist who studied GLP-1s was even a little bit surprised that there would be an effect on weight loss also. So to me, it's like a great example of just the power of basic research to help.
And we need to know, like, if things are safe in animals, because if they're not safe in animals, they're not going to be safe in humans. And I'd rather not skip that step.
No.
But yeah, we can learn so much about how medications and therapeutics are going to affect people by doing basic research. A lot of the basic research enables like the technologies that develop them, right? Like mRNA stability, like synthetic generation of insulin, like using bacteria to make stuff. And all of this is absolutely essential because they all have to come together to get a product onto the market, because how you make the drug matters, what it does to a human matters, it all matters. And it all started in a basic research lab.
Awesome. Okay, so I think we can end there. Thank you so much. This was really, really awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks. And thanks for doing what you're doing. Hopefully, I know, you know, scientists have a lot of responsibility as well over the years for not having brought our research in an understandable way to people. So hopefully the culture can shift in a way that's more positive for all Americans to understand better this cooperative system that, you know, we're doing it to help people and we need their support as well.